You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of March 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme...
Die französischen und die deutschen Ermittlungsbehörden.
French and German investigating authorities are reporting that after their findings today, they must proceed on the assumption that the co-pilot brought the plane down intentionally.
Zum Absturz gebracht hat.
We now know what caused the German wing's crash, which killed all 150 people on board. But what will it mean for the future of aviation? Also ahead, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has started his first official coalition negotiations. But forming a government may not be easy. And as Saudi Arabia begins airstrikes in Yemen, will force from above be enough to stop Houthi rebels? We'll be discussing these stories and a couple more right now on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Daniela Peled and Michael Binion. Daniela is editor at the Institute of War and Peace Reporting and a contributor to Haaretz, amongst others. Michael is the former diplomatic editor of The Times here in London. Daniela and Michael, welcome to you both. Let's begin with the latest revelations about the crash of German Wings Flight 9525 en route from Barcelona to Dusseldorf. Officials today have said that based on the information retrieved from the black box voice recorder, the most plausible explanation is that the co-pilot locked the other pilot out of the cockpit and deliberately crashed the plane. Lufthansa CEO Carsten Spohr said in a press conference today that the company's officials are speechless over the latest findings. And Michael Binion, they're not the only ones who are speechless. It's an incredibly hard story to get one's head around, isn't it?
It's absolutely chilling. It raises all sorts of dreadful possibilities. I see that one airline, Norwegian, has already immediately changed its bylaws to say that you cannot have one pilot in the plane alone, and there've always got to be two. And I suppose it is always possible that one pilot will suddenly go mad and will do something suicidal. And if this is true, how do you stop that? I mean, you can give all kinds of psychological testing beforehand, but you can't stop somebody who's determined to bring a whole plane down.
And Daniela, some aviation experts we've been talking today have said, look, this is not the first one recently. There was a flight in Mozambique where it was believed to be suicide. There was MH370, which some people have believe was probably pilot suicide as well. Do you think this is going to have much impact on people flying, or is it for so many people just such a way of life that you just have to grin and bear it?
First of all, this will have no impact on people's flying habits. People fly because they need to, because it is part of life and it's a way of life. But certainly this plays into this awful psychological fear, which I think even if you're a frequent flyer, as they say, is something that crosses your mind, that so many lives are in the hands of a very few individuals. And the idea that this particular person with such immense power over your life might suddenly decide to commit, well, not suicide, but an act of mass murder. And I think also part of the reason why things like this really catch the public imagination is because it's such a banal situation, you know, catching a very routine flight. And it really gets our very, very deep fears about how disaster can lie in something really very, very, very everyday.
Michael, do you think that airlines around the world will be not just following the Norwegian Air example and reinforcing rules about the number of people who have been in a cockpit at any one time? And I think a number of airlines do actually already enforce that. If a pilot needs to leave a cockpit, someone else steps in. So there's never just one person on their own. But do you think they'll also be increasing not just psychological tests on for their pilots, but maybe sort of taking more of a sort of invasive action towards understanding their pilots' lives and lifestyles?
I think they probably will have to, yes. I mean, as you say, it isn't the first time. There was another incident that's never been proved but widely suspected of an Egypt airplane over the Atlantic when a large number of people were killed, where a pilot apparently started chanting verses from the Quran, put the thing into a steep dive and went straight into the sea. That was not proven, but all these cases lead one to think, is there something you could do to have a psychological profile of a pilot that would be reliable? The other thing I think pilots are going to have to think about is whether to make the cockpit door absolutely as secure as it now is, because apparently when the pilot was locked out, he was desperately trying to get back in again, and it is now reinforced so that if it's locked from inside, you can't get in. Now, whether it's more dangerous to have the possibility of hijackers taking over the cockpit or keeping out somebody who somehow has got locked out, it's a delicate balance.
It is, Daniela. I want to ask you about the way a story like this now develops, because I think, you know, one thing that we've seen differently with this tragedy is the way that the families have been looked after, certainly in a far better way than those who were affected by MH370. They've been, you know, given some distance from the media. They've been dealt with, it appears so far, fairly well by the airline. Do you think for you know, news editors around the world now looking at how they focus on this story, is it a bit on the families, but also then looking into an investigation into who this man was, going through every single thing he may have uttered on social media?
Well, I'm wondering, a cynical part of me wonders where perhaps the families were treated with more respect because they're most of them Western European. I think this might have played into it. But certainly there is a very tantalising story here, which editors have explored, really. The amount of copy I've seen produced analysing or faux analysing the pilot's Facebook page is incredible. I mean, how you manage to read so much into it. There really isn't anything more that anyone can say at this moment, and speculation has been an enormous part of this story.
Indeed. You're quite right. There's not much anyone else can say on this story, so we will leave it right there. To Yemen now. Saudi Arabia last night launched airstrikes against Houthi rebels who had already taken control of the capital, Sana'a, some months ago, but were now advancing towards the southern city of Aden. The Saudi coalition appears on paper quite broad, including Egypt, Pakistan, and in some ways the US, amongst others. President Hadi, who had been in Aden, fled allegedly on a boat to Oman. I'm sure he'll end up in Saudi Arabia at some stage soon, Michael Binion. This story has been, you know, in certain parts of the media, portrayed very much as a Shia versus Sunni, Iran versus Saudi. And there is an aspect of that, of course. But Yemen is a far more complicated story than purely sectarian divisions.
Well, Yemen is a boiling cauldron of rival clans, rival ethnic groups, rival religious divisions, and all sorts of things, and that's been going on for some time. It's also on the brink of being a failed state, both politically and economically. But I think these divisions you mentioned first are still there and are at the root cause. The problem is that the rebels are backed quite openly and with very vigorous moral and possibly even military backing by Iran. And Saudi Arabia is very, very concerned at Iran spreading its influence all around.
But it's not just Iran they're backed by. And here's the odd thing. The Houthi rebels are also backed by Ali Abdullah Saleh,
well, indeed, the former president,
who is Sunni, who was backed by the Saudis all the time. And he wants the Houthis to... He fought the Houthis for years as well.
But opportunism is not something unknown in that part of the world. And he is clearly a very ambitious and opportunistic leader who never accepted the fact he was deposed. And he rather blames the Saudis, I think, for helping in forge the deal that got him out of office.
Daniela, a week or so ago, we did an edition of the Foreign Desk on Yemen, and we were talking there about this phrase, the Yemen model, which was touted by a number of Western diplomats, even as, you know, recently as last year, but certainly pretty much since Ali Abdullah Saleh was forced to step down and his vice president, Hadi, you know, became president. This was the way that you could deal with a situation like Syria or any of these other Arab uprising countries where it had been a bit awkward. No one's really talking about the Yemen model now, are they?
No, absolutely not. I mean, Yemen was a very convenient strategic base for drone strikes. We had a conveniently positioned, this time kind of semi-democratically elected chap that we could rely on. All that has completely collapsed. And the Americans have said that they're offering advice to Gulf forces doing this. I can't imagine that anything like this was not agreed with them beforehand. I imagine they're fairly happy. I mean, I imagine the region is fairly happy, large parts of it, that this is happening and that the Gulf states are doing this job to save what could be a potentially apocalyptic scenario in Yemen. The only thing is, it's airstrikes now. There's already been talks of ground attacks. I mean, situations like this can't be controlled with airstrikes completely. They can't be contained. I have to see what kind of reaction the Houthi have to this, whether this is, whether it deals them a really stunning blow, but it doesn't seem to be. It seems to be the beginning rather than a decisive move.
Michael, there's been talk about ground troops, perhaps up to 150,000. Do you really think that, you know, Egypt, Pakistan, Jordan, Sudan, United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain are going to be willing to send troops to fight and possibly die in Yemen?
Well, Saudi Arabia, without question, they certainly will. And possibly Egypt. I mean, they are also equally committed to supporting mainstream Sunni leadership. They're in a struggle now with the Muslim Brotherhood. It's no suggestion that Houthis are Muslim Brotherhood. They're rather different. But I think Egypt is very dependent on Saudi Arabia for financial aid. So if asked, they would contribute. I mean, the intriguing thing about this is that it happens only a few days before the expected announcement of a deal, interim agreement, between Iran and the United States. The Iranians, of course, are absolutely furiously denouncing the Saudi airstrike. But when the Saudis see that America may, I'm pretty sure, probably will sign some sort of deal, they're really going to be put on the spot about their own loyalties.
Daniela, the Saudis could point to one other intervention that they've made in the past few years and say, well, look, that turned out well in ways that they'd say well, which would be Bahrain, where they sent lots and lots of tanks and soldiers to, as they saw it, defend the kingdom and put down some sort of uprising. But this is, let's leave the rights and wrongs of Bahrain to one side, this is going to be a lot harder for them to solve in a way that they are going to be happy with.
Yeah, it's a completely different situation in that Yemen is incredibly poor, incredibly large number of small arms floating about, riven by all kinds of sectarian tribal divisions and so on. But I think the Saudis, it's not just about dealing a blow to Iran. The Saudis are genuinely worried. They share a very long and very porous border with Yemen. The east of the country is Shia, that's where a lot of the oil is, and they feel that they are in a position to do something about it, and they do have enormous backing when it comes to this. But also, the situation in Bahrain didn't turn into a major Iran and Gulf state showdown. It's not. I don't think it's 100% that this is how this particular situation is going to turn out. I mean, the Houthis are not like Hezbollah. They're not a proxy arm of the Iranian government. Level of support is clear. I mean, but the amount of support isn't clear. But certainly, they're not a sort of armed wing of Iran in the same way that Hezbollah are.
Michael, you've been a diplomatic editor. You talk to diplomats, you can understand the way they think. In a situation like this, when you've got Western diplomats who, let's face it, were wrong about the idea that their solutions for Yemen would work, do you think right now they just look at the immediate crisis in front of them and think, okay, how do we best deal with that? Or do you think in London, in Brussels, and particularly in Washington, D.C., there will be some moments of reflection of, you know what, actually, we should have listened to the people who knew what they were talking about?
Well, to some extent, I think the reflection may simply be, this is nothing that we need to involve ourselves in. What is it that we are expected to do, as diplomats say in the European Union or in Brussels? In Washington, it's slightly different, because Saudi Arabia has a much more important strategic relationship with the Americans. And therefore, as you say, I think coordination or at least consultation was almost essential. But I don't think there's much that Western diplomats think they really can do at the moment apart from watch and see and urge restraint for whatever worth that is.
Okay, we'll leave it there just for now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. We'll be back to talk about Nigeria, Israel, and one other thing about how we here are ruled in Britain in just a moment.
It's the show presented by me, Andrew Tuck, all about the cities we live in. The show that celebrates urban living, from tough-talking mayors and civic activists to the guy who runs a perfect neighbourhood shop and the woman who, come sunset, turns into a gorilla gardener. The Urbanist is the go-to show for anyone who wants to know what makes a great city, and also a rubbish one, and how good lighting or wise technology could shape their metropolis for the better. Join us every week for sparkling debate, global reports, and some agenda-setting interviews.
We have a chance to shape what the urban environment will be like for billions of people.
The show premieres live every Thursday, or you can subscribe to the program as a podcast at monocle.com or on SoundCloud or iTunes. The Urbanist, the program that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist, right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, still here in the studio with me, Daniela Pellad and Michael Binion. In Israel, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has begun the first official coalition negotiations, and perhaps unsurprisingly, problems have surfaced almost immediately. The Kulanu party leader Moshe Kalon cancelled his meeting with Mr. Netanyahu, scheduled for today, after he learned that ultra-Orthodox parties would be offered key economic positions. Another party leader, Naftali Bennett of the Jewish Home Party, did meet with Netanyahu, but made it clear that he would rather be in opposition if he's not given either foreign affairs or defence. Daniela, how long, let's put this in some context, how long does it normally take Israel to sort of, after an election, sort of get everyone together and work out who's getting what and how you form your coalition?
Well, this won't take very long, because despite all the hissy fits today, they can ask and they can demand, but Kahlon knows that he's going to get the finance ministry. That's clear. Bennett knows that he's not going to get foreign or defence, and that's clear. His party has shrunk. He'll be lucky to get three more junior portfolios. But this coalition, as it's working out, is such a natural right-wing coalition that they're just working out the details now. I mean, no one is going to stomp off and say, right, I'd rather be in opposition. No, thank you very much. The only thing that's clear right now is that Kahlon is going to be a finance minister. This is the job he wanted when he was in the Likud party. And the fact that Netanyahu didn't give it to him is one of the reasons why he left. And as for foreign minister, it seems likely that Lieberman will remain foreign minister. I suppose they don't have too many cuddly faces to present to the outside world right now, and he, in context, is kind of cuddly.
Well, indeed. I mean, Michael, is Avigdor Lieberman, is he there to sort of show that, well, look, in comparison, actually Netanyahu's not that bad? Or actually, now after the election, is he there to say that actually Netanyahu's worse? I'm confused.
Well, it's very difficult to say. He's there because he's no longer being investigated for corruption. I mean, that was one of the real key things that caused a problem with his last time in office. And he feels he's been vindicated and he has won votes, and therefore he is part of quite a strong new coalition when it takes shape. It will be fairly strong. It defied the critics. Netanyahu himself won a personal victory. I think one of the things that Lieberman is going to find it particularly difficult is dealing with America, which is actually extremely angry about Israel's behaviour, very disappointed in Netanyahu's victory, and I think is going to start putting as much pressure as Obama dare on Israel to reverse its positions on, say, peace talks with the Palestinians or some of the other points made during the election campaign.
Danielle, have you been pleasantly surprised at the way that the Obama administration has seems to have dealt with Netanyahu's comments both before the election, sort of, and during the, you know, certainly on the day as well? They seem to have, you know, developed some sort of wibbly wobbly backbone.
Well, I mean, even before the election, relations with Washington was as bad as they've been since the early 90s. But to be honest, I don't think things are going to go that much further, because there's a limit to how far Obama can push this this criticism of Netanyahu. I mean, don't forget, it's the bilateral ties are not about personal relations between these two people, as much as Netanyahu has done to try and destroy them. The rhetoric will be toned down. I don't think we're going to get as far in the imminent future as anything approaching financial measures. Or, I mean, let's see what happens when we go back to the UN. Let's see what happens with Palestinian declarations of statehood and other unilateral moves. And it's possible, it is conceivable, that America might not use its veto. But it was conceivable a year ago that America might not use its veto. I mean, this change is, it seems dramatic, but actually it is just part of a long deterioration. I think more problematic in the immediate future will be Israel's relationship with Europe. I think the Europeans are going to find it easier to say, I mean, some fairly minor measures could really, really upset Israel. Things like increasing the identification of settlement produce, grants, anything that hints of a boycott, of an economic or academic boycott, really, really, really puts the willies up Israel.
And Michael, do you think that there'll be more nations within Europe, within the European Union, that might follow Sweden's lead and officially recognise Palestine?
There might be, yes. It depends where that leads to. I mean, it's really just a theoretical point of view. It's a sort of declaration of moral support. It doesn't go any further than that, because it doesn't lead to practical events on the ground or any immediate change, either at the United Nations or anywhere else.
It might, in one sense, I mean, who knows exactly what's going to happen here in Britain in 6.5 weeks' time, and there's the first of I don't dare call them debates, because there are actually going to be debates between the two-party leaders tonight, but the two-party leaders here in Britain will be talking on TV. And, you know, unlikely that Labour win, and perhaps unlikely that Ed Miliband becomes Prime Minister, but the Labour Party has voted to recognise Palestine. I mean, if they were to do that in office, that would be relatively dramatic, wouldn't it?
It would certainly be a change of tactic and a change of policy, and it would be a very clear declaration that Britain doesn't follow America's automatic leadership, either at the United Nations or an international fora on this issue. It would be a dramatic change, but whether it would actually make much difference on the ground, whether it would certainly wouldn't influence the coalition in Israel in the slightest degree. I think I agree entirely with Daniela. What really would matter is if that's translated into some kind of economic measures.
But I think even economic measures, though, is largely psychological. I mean, Israel is not going to be affected in any meaningful way, even a complete boycott of goods from the West Bank. I mean, that's not the basis of its economy. All of these moves are psychological and diplomatic. It's not a question of a boycott bringing the edifice of Zionism crumbling. I mean, falling down. I think these sort of theoretical and symbolic sanctions are as powerful as any sanction, really.
Okay, and just briefly, let's move on to Nigeria now. The country is moving towards presidential elections. They take place on Saturday. They were supposed to take place back in February, but were postponed because President Goodluck Jonathan said that he wanted to deal with Boko Haram. Since he's obviously dealt with that and that's all over, Michael Binion, Goodluck Jonathan has, today, signed an agreement with his opponent, Muhammadu Buhari, trying to prevent violence during and after the elections. And Michael, quite aside from the issue of Boko Haram, elections in Nigeria have been incredibly violent in the past. More than 800 people killed last time in 2011. Do you think this sort of public agreement between the two main candidates makes it any more likely that there won't be a repeat of that this time?
marginally more likely, but I don't think it's any real guarantee. And I think these elections could still be overshadowed by another atrocity by Boko Haram. That issue is not out of the way at all. I mean, they have just kidnapped another 500 people. And if they go on at this rate, I mean, there will be a full-scale resumption of open hostilities, particularly across the north. We may get the northern neighbours intervening yet again. I don't think this is going to be an easy election at all. And it may still be possible that Goodluck Jonathan will, at the last minute, postpone them again.
Indeed, Danielle, there's that possibility. And there's also the possibility of that these elections aren't free and fair.
Well, I guess that there's more than a possibility of that. But I think still, as Michael said, I think right now the danger is more to do with security. As you said, elections in Nigeria are incredibly violent. And as we saw in Kenya, election violence can lead to really appalling consequences, but also that the threat of a mass terror attack is very real. I mean, they're taking extraordinary measures. No vehicles will be allowed to drive on the streets on election day, apart from ambulances and police cars. All borders are going to be closed. I mean, I don't know how this will affect turnout. If there are scenes of mass corruption, that doesn't really matter when it comes to turnout. But it would be a wonderful surprise if the elections don't pass off without an immense amount of violence.
Those polls are on Saturday. We'll be covering it in more detail throughout the day tomorrow on Monocle 24 and, of course, on Monday morning. Now, finally, Britain may soon find out a little bit more about what's happening inside the head of Prince Charles. The UK's highest court has today ruled that letters he sent to the government can be made public. It's long been known that Prince Charles writes letters to British ministers about the topics he's particularly interested in. The letters have been nicknamed Black Spider Memos because of the prince's sprawling handwriting. Freedom of Information campaigners have welcomed the decision of the Supreme Court. Michael, does this actually mean these letters are going to be released? Because it seems like it's still possible that the government can perhaps try to withhold them.
They can try, but I doubt if they'll succeed, not once a judgment like this has been made public. And I think that's deeply regrettable. I think that is Prince Charles he's writing in his capacity as a prince, of course, but also as a private individual, giving his views.
Oh, come on, he's not a private individual.
He's
going to be head of state.
He is, but he's not head of state yet.
But when you are head of state, you're supposed to be neutral in this country.
He's not head of state, and he's perfectly entitled to have his own views.
And we're perfectly entitled to hear what they are. And speaking personally, I hope they are excruciatingly embarrassing.
I hope he's revealed... That would take us straight to the situation in Sweden where the Prime Minister has to publish every letter written to him, which is a disaster.
Yes, how can you conduct... Sweden well known for being a terrible democracy.
It may be very democratic. It's nothing to do with that. It's to do with privacy.
But okay, it's to do with privacy, but surely it's also to do with democracy. This man is going to be our head of state. He's going to have certain responsibilities. He's going to have to decide on certain things. For example, right now, we're going into an election where the Queen, at the end of the day, might have to choose who she invites to Buckingham Palace to form a government. If it turns out that actually Prince Charles is, you know, very left-wing or very right-wing, shouldn't the British people know that?
As head of state, that's an entirely different matter. Prince Charles is not head of state. When he acts in the official capacity, deputising for the Queen, of course, everything that he says must be on the record, must be revealed, must be cleared. But in this capacity, when he's complaining about architecture or whatever he's going on about, or the environment or something, he had a whole lot of views that he pushes quite strongly, he's not acting in the job as head of state.
Daniela, do you think it would be as lightweight, these views, as merely about architecture or perhaps about the environment?
I don't really want to be cruel to our future king, but I will be. I think that all of his views are likely to be lightweight. I mean, this is a man who spent his whole life preparing for a role which is yet to take. I don't know what qualifications he has to talk about anything from the health service to architecture to anything from his delightfully gilded cage.
I would take that up. Gilded cage. The Prince's Trust does more for disadvantaged youth than almost all other charities in Britain.
Well, he has to be of some use.
Well, yes, but some use in a gilded cage. That doesn't mean that every single thing he thinks has to be published the next morning.
I'm very glad it isn't.
Michael, I know you say, look, when he's head of state, it will be different.
Yes.
But do you not think it matters that, you know, he might have some views? You don't think, you know, we have a right to know what he thinks about certain political things?
Well, he's made it pretty clear about what he thinks in public speeches. I mean, many times, and probably for Daniela far too many times. He is a strong environmental campaigner, and probably that's what his letters say.
There we are. We shall soon see what his letters say. Michael Binion and Daniela Pellet, thank you both very much indeed. Midori House was produced by Tom Hall and Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Mike Hewin. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Andrew Muller will be back tomorrow with Midori House, 1800 hours here in London, 1400 hours in New York. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Goodbye.